dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is on Welcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. It seems fitting this Memorial Day weekend to take a look at the so-called justice system. The police and the military are two sides of the same coin, institutions that bestow licenses to kill on certain individuals and demand that the rest of us submit in the name of law and order, whether national or international. Are the police and military institutions that protect our security internally and externally, as our leaders would have us believe? Or are they institutions designed to use violence and coercion to preserve and protect a social order that allows some to possess extreme wealth and power on the backs of others? Whenever an incident of police violence or corruption surfaces, there is an immediate effort by the powers that be to assert that the incident is an aberration. How many times do such incidents need to occur before they are acknowledged as standard operating procedure, integral to the nature and purposes of the system? Set the stage for tonight's program by reading from an article that appeared in the May 23rd edition of the Wall Street Journal. It's called Spit Happens, Police in Uniform Are Leery of Fast Food Places. The Secret Sauce Could Have Something in It for Them, Something Not Very Nice, by Jennifer Ordonez. Hours into a long Sunday shift, Chris T. Phillips, a North Carolina highway patrolman, was looking forward to his order of Taco Bell nachos. Pulling away from the drive-through window, he shoveled into his mouth a mound of meat and cheese. Then he noticed something. It was clear and slimy in appearance, Sergeant Phillips recalls. Dangling from a chip, state lab tests later confirmed, was phlegm. Sergeant Phillips said that an employee who was fired after the incident had complained of being harassed by police about his skateboarding. Amy Sherwood, spokesman for Tricon Global Restaurants, which owns Taco Bell, declines to comment other than to say the company, quote, has the highest admiration and respect for the work of police officers, close quote, who are always welcome to eat at its restaurants. Now, nearly 4 years later, it is hard for Sergeant Phillips to stomach fast food. You realize that people will do that to you, and eating is just never the same. The docket of food tampering cases with police's victims is growing, and many officers say they think twice about ordering fast food while in uniform. Some blame the teenagers fast food places hire to do jobs that don't pay well and are hard to fill. Others cite anti-police sentiment in the general public. It's consistent with the erosion of respect for authority figures, says Jim Pasco, executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police. The article goes on to catalog a list of incidents coast to coast where substances such as spit, urine, and oven cleaner were added to fast food orders of police officers. One generous food tamperer even laced a taquito with marijuana. What is interesting about the article is that it acknowledges growing anti-police sentiment and, quote, the erosion of respect for authority figures. On what basis ought one to respect these authority figures? Consider this report from the May 24th issue of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Going backwards, deputy fired for WTOX is reinstated, pepper spraying of two in car appropriate arbitrator rules by Lewis Cam. A Kings County Sheriff's deputy who was fired for using excessive force during the 1999 World Trade Organization unrest in Seattle will get his job back, an arbitrator ruled yesterday. Sheriff Dave Reichert fired John Vanderwalker in April 2000. After a long internal investigation into accusations that he pepper-sprayed two art students in a car and kicked a medic as she knelt on the ground in unrelated incidents December 1, 1999, during WTO protests. Yesterday's ruling stunned Reichert and other officials, said Sergeant John Urquhart, spokesman for the sheriff's office. The arbitrator basically ruled that it was okay to pepper spray those girls in the car, and it was okay to kick that medical worker while she was on the ground, Urquhart said. We disagree, and we believe it was a legitimate termination. Vanderwalker, 48, was a 19-year veteran on the force before his firing. When asked about his reinstatement, he told the Associated Press, "This is great." Ruling on an appeal to last year's firing of Vanderwalker, arbitrator Michael DeGrasse ordered the Kings County Sheriff's Office to reinstate the former deputy to his patrol position in the Maple Valley precinct. The binding ruling also compels the county to compensate Vanderwalker for back wages and lost off-duty and overtime pay. Both WTO incidents were captured on videotape. In one of the most widely publicized incidents stemming from the WTO, two art students shooting footage from a car in a Capitol Hill parking lot captured an officer as he approached them, ordered them to roll down their window, and then doused them with pepper spray. Although the officer was unrecognizable in a gas mask, Vanderwalker came forward several weeks later. The students Shauna Belaski and Melissa Benton sued King County over the incident and received $100,000 as part of a settlement. In the second incident, caught by a news camera, an apparently disoriented woman wearing a red and white armband and holding a first aid kit is crouching on the ground. An officer then runs up and kicks her in the back, knocking her forward. Sheriff's officials have said they identified Vanderwalker as that officer by enlarging images to read his name on his helmet. In his 10-page ruling, DeGrasse, an independent professional arbitrator hired by both sides to rule on the appeal, said Vanderwalker's use of force was appropriate under the circumstances. He also ruled that Vanderwalker did not lie in his statement to sheriff's officials about the incidents, a contention that sheriff's officials held as part of the grounds for his firing. That was from the May 24th Seattle Post-Intelligencer. What circumstances would have rendered Deputy Vanderwalker's use of force inappropriate? Different occupants in the car? A different car? Maybe a Mercedes or Cadillac? Do you think Amadou Diallo would have been gunned down by police in front of his New York City apartment if he had been white and his apartment had been located in a wealthy area of town? Unequal justice is not justice at all.
Oh, my mama told me, 'cause she said she learned the hard way. Says she wanna spare the children. She say don't give a say your soul away, 'cause all that you have is your soul. So don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth, 'cause all that you have is your soul.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is perhaps the world's most famous death row prisoner. The black radical journalist from Philly who moonlighted as a cabbie has spent 20 years on death row falsely convicted for the shooting of a police officer. Like most poor people, he was assigned an incompetent lawyer. He has asserted that he was framed by the Philadelphia police because of sympathetic coverage of the MOVE organization, a mostly black group whose communal residence was bombed by the Philly police. His membership in the Black Panther Party was used as justification by the prosecution to demand the death sentence. A corrupt and racist judge would not allow him to conduct his own defense and removed him from the courtroom for a major portion of his trial. In all these years, Mumia has not spoken about what happened on the night of the shooting. With a new team of lawyers, Mumia has finally spoken out. Elliot Grossman, recently retained as Mumia's attorney, spoke with Vinny of Free Radio Santa Cruz about new evidence that has surfaced that clears Mumia completely. You will also hear a sworn declaration from a professional killer that reveals that the officer's death was a hit ordered by the Philly Police Department itself.
I'd like to start off just introducing the other members of the legal team. Marlene Kamish, an attorney from Chicago, is the first attorney who was retained by Mumia after he discharged his prior attorneys. We've also retained a British barrister from London, Nick Brown, and a local Philadelphia attorney, J. Michael Farrell. So these are the attorneys who are now representing Mumia. At the press conference, the press conference was conducted outside of the federal courthouse in downtown Philadelphia, and we had just filed new evidence in the courthouse for the judge to review and also file the necessary legal papers to officially come onto the case as Mumia's new attorneys. And there's a number of different things that came up, the first of which, and I think perhaps the most important of which, is that Mumia himself has now submitted his own statement, a sworn statement that is filed in court, which is his testimony as to what happened that night. And I'd like to take an opportunity to read Mumia's statement as to what happened.
Please.
If we could do that now.
Yeah, please.
All right, this, as I said, this is sworn testimony under oath, which Mumia signed at the prison on May the 3rd, on Thursday, and which we filed in federal court on May the 4th, on Friday. And this is what Mumia's statement says. I, Mumia Abu-Jamal, declare, I am the petitioner in this action. If called as a witness, I could and would testify to the following from my own personal knowledge. I did not shoot police officer Daniel Faulkner. I had nothing to do with the killing of Officer Faulkner. I am innocent. At my trial, I was denied the right to defend myself. I had no confidence in my court-appointed attorney, who never even asked me what happened the night I was shot and the police officer was killed, and I was excluded from at least half the trial. Since I was denied all my rights at my trial, I did not testify. I would not be used to make it look like I had a fair trial. I did not testify in the post-conviction proceedings in 1995 on the advice of my attorney, Leonard Wineglass, who specifically told me not to testify. Now, for the first time, I have been given an opportunity to tell what happened to me in the early morning hours of December 9, 1981. This is what happened. As a cabbie, I often chose 13th and Locust Street because it was a popular club area with a lot of foot traffic. I worked out of United Cab on the night of 12/9/81. I believe I had recently returned from dropping off a fare in West Philly. I was filling out my log when I heard some shouting. I glanced in my rearview mirror and saw a flashing dome light of a police cruiser. This wasn't unusual. I continued to fill out my log trip sheet when I heard what sounded like gunshots. I looked again into my rearview mirror and saw people running up and down Locust. As I scanned, I recognized my brother standing in the street, staggering and dizzy. I immediately exited the cab and ran to his scream. As I came across the street, I saw a uniformed cop turn toward me, gun in hand, saw a flash, and went down to my knees. I closed my eyes and sat still, trying to breathe. The next thing that I remember, I felt myself being kicked, hit, and being brought out of a stupor. When I opened my eyes, I saw cops all around me. They were hollering and cursing, grabbing and pulling on me. I felt faint, finding it hard to talk. As I looked through this cop crowd all around me, I saw my brother, blood running down his neck, and a cop lying on his back on the pavement. I was pulled to my feet and then rammed into a telephone pole, beaten where I fell, and thrown into a paddy wagon. I think I slept until I heard the door open, and a white cop in a white shirt came in cursing and hit me in the forehead. I don't remember what he said much, except a lot of N-word and vulgarity and whatnot. I believe he left and I slept. I don't remember the wagon moving for a while, and when it did, for some time. I awoke to hear the driver speaking over the radio about his prisoner. I was informed by the anonymous crackle on the radio that I was en route to the police administration building a few blocks away. Then it sounded like ID'd as M1 came on the radio band telling the driver to go to Jefferson Hospital. Upon arrival, I was thrown from the wagon to the ground and beaten. I was beaten again at the doors of Jefferson. Because of the blood in my lungs, it was difficult to speak and impossible to holler. I never confessed to anything because I had nothing to confess to. I never said I shot the policeman. I did not shoot the policeman. I never said I hoped he died. I would never say something like that. I declare, under penalty of perjury, under the laws of the United States, that the above is true and correct and was executed by me on 3 May 2001 at Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. Signed, Mumia Abu Jamal.
Now, this is the first time Mumia has come forward. Why is it now? Why has he waited so long? I mean, you mentioned earlier that he was told not to testify in 1995, or he mentioned in his statement. Why is it that he has waited this long, though, otherwise?
Well, I think that the important thing is that Mumia has now provided sworn testimony in court as to what happened. He explains in his declaration that the attorney who was previously representing him and who continued to represent him until he was discharged and replaced told him specifically and advised him specifically not to testify. So I think it's clear the reason he hasn't testified was, as he explains in his declaration.
Okay. Now, in addition to the statement and affidavit by Mumia, there was also one filed by his brother, William Cook, who also has finally come forward for the first time with sworn statements. What is the gist of his statement?
Yes, what William Cook basically says, and what I could do is read a part of his declaration, is that he explains that he was, you know, in his car, in his Volkswagen, and he had a passenger in his Volkswagen, and he was stopped by the police car. He explains in his declaration that he did not attack or hit the police officer, but that the police officer, they had had a disagreement, basically, because William Cook was upset that he'd been stopped because he wasn't doing anything wrong, and the police officer hit him several times with some object, and then he went back to his car to get his registration, basically his papers. I assume his registration, his driver's license, etc. And as he was looking in his car to try to find these things, all of a sudden, shooting started. And I'll read you this part of it. When I first saw this is after the shooting started. When I first saw my brother, he was running. He was feet away from me. We hadn't made any plans to meet that night or anything like that. And I didn't even realize that he came around that area there to pick up fares. He had nothing in his hands. I heard a shot, and I saw him stumble. I didn't see who shot him. He was stumbling forward. And then William Cook explains that he looked back to see what was going on in his car, and that his passenger had disappeared. And he doesn't know exactly when the passenger left, but the door was open and the passenger was gone. Now, afterwards, after this whole incident was over and after Billy Cook had been released by the police, the person who was his passenger told William Cook that there had been a plot to kill police officer Faulkner. And I'll quote this part from the affidavit. He told me that he was armed on that night and participated in the shooting. This is the passenger who was in William Cook's car at the time.
That's Ken Freeman, is that correct?
That's what's said in the affidavit.
Now, that's also the ID, isn't that? Wasn't that the ID that was found on Officer
Faulkner? No, there's an ID from another gentleman.
That's from another.
That was found. It's unclear from the evidence. There's some contradictions in the evidence whether this was allegedly found on the officer or whether this was found in the car.
Okay.
But there was an ID from another person, and that's never really been satisfactorily explained what the ID was doing there. But in any case, William Cook goes forward in his affidavit, and he explains that he was taken to the police station. He says, when they had me in the police station, they threatened to kill me and throw me in the river. I have been afraid for my life since that night. And he continues onward and says that he's referring to the attorney who represented Mumia at his original trial. I remember Jackson coming to my house several times. My mother and sister were there. I don't remember him ever interviewing me. I just remember him trying to calm us. And he says that if Jackson had wanted him to testify, he would have done it, but he was never asked to testify. See, this is what he says. If they, parentheses Jackson, had said they wanted me to testify, I would have done it, but they never did. And then he explains that he was expecting to testify at the PCRA, which was the post-conviction proceedings, which happened in 1995. And he says that one of the attorneys wanted him to testify, but Leonard, referring to Leonard Wineglass, didn't, so I didn't testify. But then he states that he will testify now. And then the declaration from William Cook concludes with the following. Mumia was not holding a gun. Mumia never intervened in anything between me and the cop. I had nothing to do with the shooting or killing of the police officer. My brother, Mumia Abu Jamal, had nothing to do with shooting or killing the policeman. And that is the declaration of William Cook, which was signed on April the 29th of this year. And that was filed in federal court on Friday also. Now, there's a number of significant points here, of course, one of which, and having now obtained this evidence, a number of assumptions that a lot of people have been making about the case are clearly not true, and the case needs to be viewed from a different perspective, a completely new perspective, than previously, and you know, we'll get into that particularly when we get to the declaration of Arnold Beverly, who's the man who's come forward and stated that he is the person who actually shot Officer Faulkner and not Mumia Abu Jamal. But one of the points that's come forward is that Mumia actually did not see what happened between the police officer and his brother. People assume that Mumia saw the police officer beating his brother and went forward to intervene in that situation. But actually, Mumia didn't even see that. All that Mumia was aware of was he heard gunshots and he saw his brother staggering around, and then he went, you know, to the scene to see what was going on and what he could do. But he actually didn't even know that the police officer had beaten his brother. And then the other significant, and of course, the other significant fact is that although Mumia, since, you know, he was a cab driver, and cab driving is a very dangerous occupation, and he'd been robbed before at gunpoint, Mumia did have a gun, but he never drew his gun. He never had his gun out.
Right.
And his brother's testimony confirms that. His brother says that Mumia had nothing in his hands, i.e., he didn't have a gun in his hands or anything else in his hands. He just came upon the scene, and the next thing that happened was that Mumia himself got shot, and he was down.
Yeah, it sounds like, according to William Cook's testimony, that the officer had already been shot before Mumia even exited the cab. At least that's what I gather from reading this testimony.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, you know, you have to actually go to the scene where this thing happened, or, you know, to be able to understand it. It's a cross street. There's 13th Street and Locust Street are cross streets. And where the incident occurred was on Locust Street, just, I think, I'm trying to remember my directions. Okay, 13th Street runs north and south, and Locust Street runs east and west. And the incident occurred on Locust Street, on the south side of Locust Street, east of 13th Street.
Right.
Mumia was going north on 13th Street, had crossed Locust Street, and had pulled over about 52 feet past Locust Street on the left-hand side of the street, it's a one-way street, and was double-parked in front of a nightclub, an after-hours club, waiting for potential passengers to come out of the club. This happened at 4 in the morning when the after-hours clubs close, and, you know, numerous people come out. So when this happened, he got out of the cab, and then he ran basically diagonally from where he was to the location on Locust Street. So, you know, it took some time period for him to get from one point to the other. In any case, I think what you pointed out is basically the situation. The officer was shot before Mumia arrived on the scene. And that's also what Arnold Beverly says in his declaration, which we'll get to in a moment here. But as I was saying, the testimony from William Cook also confirms that there was no gun in Mumia's hands, that there was nothing in his hands. And in fact, when I said that we need to look at the evidence from a new perspective, now that we have the new evidence, if we go back and look at the evidence, even the prosecution's evidence, their alleged evidence at the original trial, it all fits into place now in a way that shows that, in fact, Mumia is innocent and didn't do it, because it's very significant that none of the prosecution witnesses testified that they actually saw a gun in Mumia's hands at the time the shooting took place. None of them did, and there's a good reason for that, which is that Mumia didn't have a gun in his hands, and Mumia didn't shoot the police officer.
Right. Even had they testified, I mean, I know a few of the witnesses have recanted their testimony in 1995 at the PCRA hearing, and one woman, her name slips me, I believe it was Jackson?
Jones, Veronica Jones.
Veronica Jones. Was arrested off the stand at that hearing after she recanted her initial testimony.
Yes, and she tried to point out that the police officers told her at the time that she was originally interrogated that if she went along with them, basically they would let her continue to work as a prostitute and not arrest her or harass her, and in her case, also not prosecute her on these weapons charges they had, which could have landed her in prison for a number of years. But they also told her they would give her the same deal that they had given to Cynthia White, who was one of the main witnesses against me at the trial, who was also a prostitute, who had numerous arrests, and you know, they obviously had the capacity to on the one hand entice and on the other hand threaten her to do what they wanted or else. So at this point it might be appropriate to move to the declaration of Arnold Beverly.
Right. Now, Arnold Beverly has come forward now and is alleging that he is actually the killer of Officer Faulkner. Can we talk about that?
Well, what Arnold Beverly has stated in his declaration is, first of all, Arnold Beverly has signed a declaration under penalty of perjury, which is basically the equivalent of a sworn statement. And we have taken this document, we have filed this in federal court, so we now have actual testimony by Arnold Beverly, just as if he was in court himself. We have written testimony that was filed in court on Friday. And Arnold Beverly has stated that he will come forward. He stated to us that he will come forward and he will testify in court and to what he states in his declaration. So I think perhaps the best thing to do is to actually let Arnold Beverly speak in his own words and read Arnold Beverly's declaration.
Okay.
So this is what Arnold Beverly says. I, Arnold R. Beverly, state that the following facts are true and correct. I was present when Police Officer Daniel Faulkner was shot and killed in the early morning hours of December 9, 1981, near the corner of Locust and 13th Streets. I have personal knowledge that Mumia Abu-Jamal did not shoot Police Officer Faulkner. I was hired, along with another guy, and paid to shoot and kill Faulkner. I had heard that Faulkner was a problem for the mob and corrupt policemen because he interfered with the graft and payoffs made to allow illegal activity, including prostitution, gambling, drugs, without prosecution in the Center City area. Faulkner was shot in the back and then in the face before Jamal came on the scene. Jamal had nothing to do with the shooting. Before the shooting, I was shown a picture of Faulkner and told that Faulkner was supposed to check something at Johnny D's at 13th and Locust sometime in the early morning hours of December 9. Two of us were hired for the shooting so that either of us could take the opportunity to make the hit, get the job done, and leave. The other guy gave me a .38 caliber policeman special, and I was also carrying my own .22 caliber revolver. I waited at the speed line entrance. By the way, the speed line is the subway in Philadelphia. I waited at the speed line entrance at the northeast of corner of Locust and 13th at the parking lot. I was wearing a green camouflage army jacket. The other guy waited on the south side of Locust Street, east of 13th Street, towards Camac Street. While I was waiting at the speed line entrance for Faulkner to arrive at the location, I saw police officers in the area. Two undercover policemen were standing on the west side of 13th Street, north of Locust. Also, a uniformed police officer was sitting in a car in the corner of the parking lot. They were there while the shooting of Faulkner took place. I was not worried about the police being there, since I believe that since I was hired by the mob to shoot and kill Faulkner, any police officers on the scene would be there to help me. After a while, I saw Faulkner get out of a small police car parked behind a VW parked on Locust Street, east of 13th Street. Faulkner was alone. He got out of the police car and went up to the VW. I heard a shot ring out coming from east on Locust Street. Faulkner fell on his knee on the sidewalk next to the VW. I heard another shot, and it must have grazed my left shoulder. I felt something hard on my left shoulder. I grabbed at my shoulder and got blood on my hand. I ran across Locust Street and stood over Faulkner, who had fallen backwards on the sidewalk. I shot Faulkner in the face at close range. Jamal was shot shortly after that by a uniformed police officer who arrived on the scene. Cop cars came from all directions. Foot patrol also arrived. I saw a white shirt getting out of a car in the middle of the 13th and Locust intersection, just as I was going down to the speed line steps. I left the area underground through the speed line system and by prearrangement met a police officer who assisted me when I exited the speed line underground about three blocks away. A car was waiting for me and I left the Center City area. The foregoing is stated subject to the penalties of 18 Pennsylvania Criminal Statutes, Section 4904, relating to unsworn falsification to authorities. Signed, Arnold R. Beverly, 6899. So this is a basically the equivalent of a sworn declaration that was signed by Arnold Beverly back in June of 1999.
Why is it that this has just now come forward?
Because when we took over the case as the new attorneys, reviewing the files of the previous attorneys, which, by the way, we're still doing because we have like 50 boxes of files that we're still going through. But in the course of beginning to go through the files, we found this document. And when we found this document, we took some steps to verify it, and one of the attorneys actually was able to contact Mr. Beverly and interview him on a number of occasions, and we made a determination that, in our opinion, based upon the interviews of Mr. Beverly, reviewing his declaration, and looking at the other evidence and information we have at our disposal, it appears to us that this is credible testimony. And so, having made that determination, we decided that it was our responsibility to immediately file this with the court, mm-hmm. and that's what we did. Now, there's some interesting, I mean, obviously, there's a number of interesting points here, one of which is that it goes back to the point that you brought up earlier, that according to this declaration, as well as William Cook's declaration, Mumia was shot after Faulkner was shot. And indeed, according to Arnold Beverly's declaration, Faulkner didn't even shoot Mumia. Right. Another police officer who arrived on the scene afterwards shot Mumia. Now, the reason I'm bringing attention to this particular point is that at the original trial, Mumia's attorney tried to bring up evidence that someone other than Faulkner had shot Mumia, and Judge Sabo refused to let that evidence in. And what that evidence was is kind of interesting. There was an early police report shortly after the incident took place which stated that Jamal was shot by officers arriving on the scene afterwards. And the prosecution did not hand that over to Mumia's attorney, although they're required by law to do so. But Mumia's attorney was given that by a confidential source that he had in the police department. So this evidence corroborates Beverly's evidence that, in fact, that's what happened. And, of course, if Officer Faulkner did not shoot Mumia, then that shows that, you know, there was a lot more going on than had been put forth in the prosecution scenario. Now, in terms of other evidence, if we go back, that corroborates the evidence by Arnold Beverly and also kind of takes all the previous evidence and reassembles it in a different pattern.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of points that are very interesting here. Arnold Beverly states in his declaration that he was wearing a green army jacket. Now, that's very significant because there's numerous witnesses who testified at the previous trial and witnesses who were interrogated by the police but weren't called to testify who all said that the person who shot Faulkner was wearing a green army jacket. And Mumia was not wearing a green army jacket. They recovered, and part of the evidence is the jacket he was wearing that night, which is a white and red and I think black quilted jacket, which is clearly not a green army jacket. So the fact that it was Beverly who was wearing the green army jacket is very significant. Also in William Cook's declaration, he also states that the passenger in his car was wearing a green army jacket that night because the passenger had previously been in the army and he always wore his green army jacket around. Now, the other thing is, when I was in Philadelphia, I went with Attorney Marlon Kamish to the scene where this incident took place at 13th and Locust. And it's very interesting to look at that scene. You know, the neighborhood's changed a lot in the last 20 years. I mean, in that time period, this was a neighborhood of after-hour clubs. It was a pretty seedy neighborhood. It was a neighborhood where there was a lot of prostitution, a lot of drug sales. It was a pretty heavy-duty neighborhood. But it was also kind of like a popular spot for people to go, you know, for after-hour clubs. Now it's gotten very yuppified.
Mm-hmm, it sure has.
But it's still basically intact. And the thing is, it's an older part of the city. You know, Philadelphia is one of the first American cities. It's an older part of the city where the streets are very small and very narrow. And it's a very small area. And when we went there, I mean, it looks almost like a movie set or kind of like, you know, Disneyland or something in the sense that this is not a wide, modern street. This is a very small area. And what I'm getting to is when you look at the scene, this is a perfect ambush site. If you were going to plan to kill somebody and shoot them down, this is a perfect place to do it because the area is so small. What it means is that you could have a couple of people lying in wait for the victim, and they could carry out the shooting using handguns, which have a short range and effectively get the job done. Plus, there's a number of places where the people waiting for the victim to show up can hide and then emerge from their hiding places, carry out the killing, and then escape very easily. For example, Arnold Beverly said that he was standing at the speed line steps. You know, on three corners of that intersection, there are entrances to the subway system. And what that means is you can stand there down on the steps that are going down under the street, and there's like big metal, there's kind of like handrails with big metal, big pieces of metal.
It's almost like a fence.
Right there, so that you could kind of like stand down on the steps behind the metal, be protected. Nobody could really see you, but you could see the area. And when the victim emerged, you know, when the victim appeared, you could come up the steps, just like Arnold Beverly said he did, shoot the victim, and then you could, you got three different sets of subway stairs that you can then go right back down again, and you're underground, and you can go like three blocks, you can go down about three blocks to the next major street, and there's no one out there on the street who can see you. And generally, the thing about the Philadelphia subway system is there aren't that many people on it, especially at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
I don't know if the subway's even running. But you can just dive down under the street, and then there's like no witnesses out on the street to see you, and you can just go, you know, either direction up to the next exit, emerge, jump into a car, and you're off. So, and that was basically Beverly's story. Now, with regard to the other shooter, or, you know, the accomplice, that, you know, Beverly says he had an accomplice. Presumably, the other shots that he refers to that were fired by his accomplice. The accomplice was down on Locust Street on the other side of where, you know, Faulkner came out of his squad car, on the south side of the street, down towards Kamak or Kamak Street. Kamak Street is actually a little alleyway type street,
real,
a very narrow one, that's going down towards the next major street of 12th Street. And before you get to Kamak Street, there's another kind of very narrow alley between Kamak and 13th Street where the shooting took place. So the accomplice could very easily have hidden right around the corner of a building there at Kamak Street, and then when Faulkner emerged, came up closer and hidden right around the corner of a building at this little narrow alleyway, and then come out when the time was right to begin shooting, and as soon as the shooting was over, just run back down Kamak Street, or run back to the alley, and just run down the alley and run away, and no one would see him. So, I mean, this was, if you were going to plan to ambush somebody, this is like a perfect ambush site, which also makes, you know, the account, I think, plausible that this is the way it happened, and also explains some of the earlier evidence. There's a number of witnesses who testified that they saw one or two people running away from the scene after Faulkner was shot.
Now, Arnold Beverly, in his statement, says he was shot in the shoulder. Officer Faulkner was shot once in the back and once in the face, but it sounds like there was a third shot somewhere there that hit Arnold Beverly. And also, I mean, he also stated that he had an accomplice who was waiting, I don't have it exactly in front of me, but waiting at another entrance. Where was it? The other guy waited on the south side of Laurel, of Locust.
Locust, yes.
East of 13th, towards Kamak.
Towards Kamak Street.
But then in William Cook's testimony, he doesn't quite say this, but it's as I read it, it sounded as if he almost points the finger at Ken Freeman, or the person he refers to as Poppy, in his testimony.
Well, the thing is, he says he doesn't really see, he didn't really see what happened. All he knew is that the passenger in his car was gone, you know, at some point during the incident, but that the passenger later told him that he had been part of a plot to shoot Faulkner. Now, it's, you know, entirely possible, and in fact, you know, makes sense that if somebody, I mean, I guess what we need to do is take a step back and look at another major part of this. What Arnold Beverly is saying is that he was hired as a hitman with an accomplice by basically corrupt elements within the police department itself who were working hand in hand with the with organized crime with regard to running the prostitution and the numbers and the other criminal activities in Center City, Philadelphia, and that it was these people who hired him, and it was these people who wanted to get rid of Faulkner because Faulkner was getting in the way and presumably was not willing to go along with, you know, taking the bribes and, you know, doing the other things that were that the corrupt police were involved in. So it's entirely possible that, and quite plausible, that if somebody upstairs someplace planned this whole thing and hired people, that they might have hired some people, you know, that everybody involved in the plot didn't know who everybody else was. I mean, that makes very good sense. And there may have been, you know, some people, you know, someone was supposed to be in one place and they didn't know who their accomplices were going to be, but they knew that other people might be there, or, you know, and they had a particular job to do. And then there were other people who were supposed to be in another place and they're, you know, carry out this other part of the job. So what it sounds like is that there were at least three people involved in pulling this thing off at the scene. And in terms of the physical evidence, this took place in front of 1234 Locust Street, and after the incident, there was a bullet recovered from the door at 1234 Locust Street, and there were bullet fragments from two other bullets recovered from the door at 1234 Locust Street. So it looks like three bullets went into the door at 1234 Locust, right in front of where this occurred. One bullet went into Mumia. At least two bullets went into Officer Faulkner. And also in reviewing the evidence, the physical evidence, there's a bullet that went into Faulkner's jacket and then went through his jacket, basically. Went in one side of his jacket and out another side, and apparently did not pass through Faulkner.
Didn't hit his body.
Right.
Okay.
So that gives us another shot. And there's somewhat there's evidence that there are a number of shots fired.
Well, Ken Freeman, it appears that was obviously, or it appears to be involved in this incident or crime, murder. Where is Ken Freeman now?
He's dead. Ken Freeman, see, this is something that's very odd that was brought up earlier, which was the day after the Philadelphia police bombed the Move House in downtown Philadelphia. You may recall there were a number of confrontations between the Move organization and the Philadelphia police, and the Move people, there's a big dispute about this house they were living in. The police wanted to come in, supposedly, to inspect the house, and the Move people were refusing to let them in because they considered police... It went on for a couple of months, with the police having the house surrounded and not letting them have any electricity or water or food, etc. Finally, the police actually sent a police helicopter over the house, dropped a bomb on the house, blew up and destroyed the house,
and
killed a number
homes.
Of people, including children, and burned down, as a result, like two blocks of Philadelphia, burning down people's houses. The day after this happened, Kenneth Freeman was found naked with his hands handcuffed behind him with a hypodermic needle in his arm in a vacant lot, supposedly having overdosed. The autopsy report said that he died of a heart attack, which is rather suspicious circumstances.
Wow.
So.
And he was found May 14th, 1985, the day after the Move bombing.
After the Move bombing. So wow. If, in fact, he was involved in the incident, it may well be that the people who planned the incident decided that this was a necessary time to keep his mouth shut.
And with the cover of all the news around the Move siege, it would easily have just probably slipped right through unnoticed.
Right, but yeah, the publicity around the Move thing just dominated, you know, all of the media, so I'm sure, you know, there was nothing else really came out at that time. So, here we have it, and what we see now is that basically what was happening here, I guess before I get into, you know, kind of trying to comment on the situation, there's another piece of important evidence that I'd like to point to, which we also filed, which is that we filed an affidavit by Donald Hersing. Donald Hersing is a very important witness because Donald Hersing had been a private detective, and he was a confidential source, in other words, an informer for the FBI, back in the same period that this incident occurred, where Mumia was shot and the police officer was killed. And during the time that Mumia's case was on trial, Donald Hersing was an informant for the FBI in an investigation. Actually, there were three independent FBI investigations taking place in this time period of corruption in the Philadelphia Police Department. And there was a major series of articles in the Philadelphia Inquirer about Donald Hersing and about the whole situation of corruption in the Philadelphia Police Department. As a result of these investigations, the assistant chief of police in Philadelphia was convicted of corruption-related charges and removed from the police department. The head of homicide was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in a federal indictment. Approximately 30 police officers, including the head of the central division. And this is very significant because this incident, because police officer Faulkner was working out of the 6th Precinct, and the 6th Precinct was part of the central division. The police, I think it was a captain or inspector is what they call him back there. The police inspector in charge of the central division was also convicted of corruption-related charges and removed from the police department. And a police inspector who came on the scene of the incident after Faulkner and Mumia were shot, and who was the ranking officer in charge of the whole investigation at the crime scene, he resigned from the police department the day after Mumia's trial, and I believe was also named as a unindicted co-conspirator.
He resigned?
Yes. He was named... excuse me. Yeah, he resigned from the police department the day after. No, actually, he was... he eventually wound up being convicted as well. He did not testify at Mumia's trial. The day after the trial was over, he resigned from the police department. Now...
what were his stated reasons for resigning?
I don't know that. However, in Donald Hersing's... now, see, Donald Hersing was actually... he was operating what was called a modeling studio in Philadelphia. And a modeling studio was basically a brothel, or a, in common parlance, a whorehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And in his affidavit, and also in these newspaper articles that were published at the time in the Philadelphia Inquirer, he basically said that he was getting sick of the whole situation because of all the payoffs he had to make to the Philadelphia police to operate his business and the continuous police harassment. So he went to the FBI, and the FBI took him in as an informer and wired him for sound and had him continue his activities so they could bring a case against the corrupt police officers involved. And I'd just like to read briefly a couple of points from the affidavit of Donald Hersing, which we also filed in court last Friday. It says here, Inspector John Benedetto took over as commanding officer of the Central Division of the Philadelphia Police Department on about June 1, 1981. I first met D. Benedetto in August 1981. At that meeting, D. Benedetto personally told me that when he took over the Central Division in June, he had gathered his officers together and informed them, from that point on, all payoff money was to be passed up to him, D. Benedetto. Whereupon, he would return to each vice squad member a sum of money, about $50. During this conversation, D. Benedetto asked me if I had been making payments to any of his officers. When I informed him that I had been paying $500 a month to a vice officer, George Woods, D. Benedetto became outraged because Woods had not been delivering that money to him, D. Benedetto. And D. Benedetto said that he would take care of Woods because he, Woods, had been disloyal. A few days later, D. Benedetto told me he had demoted Woods to the status of a uniformed officer and had transferred him to another district. I continued making payments to D. Benedetto during the fall of 1981 and the spring of 1982 via his lieutenant, John Smith. Now, what basically went on is that the police would go to the people who operated the houses of prostitution and also go to the individual prostitutes and demand that they pay them protection money, basically, just like the mafia does, and that if they didn't pay them protection money, they would raid them and throw the prostitutes in jail and disrupt the business. So all the prostitutes and all the whorehouse owners in, you know, central Philadelphia were all paying protection money to the police. And what the police would do is they would send, you know, on a regular basis, a police officer would go to, you know, the whorehouse owner and or the prostitutes, and pick, and they'd be bagmen, just like mafia bagmen, and they'd pick up the payoff money, and then they would come back and they would deliver it to the higher-ups. And then everybody involved, you know, would get their little percentage of it, but the money would go, you know, up the chain of command to whoever was directing it. And this guy who became the head of the Central Division of the Philadelphia Police Department apparently had previously been in charge of their Internal Affairs Division, who was supposed to clean up the corruption in the police department. Then they sent him over to the Central Division, and then we've got the statement by Hersing in his affidavit that when he took over the Central Division, he basically centralized all the payoffs and made sure that all the payoff money in the Central Division was going to come into his hands.
Wow.
Now, the other thing, and this is very significant as well, is that you have these after-hours clubs in Philadelphia where they would, even though legally you were supposed to stop serving alcohol at 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning, they would continue to serve, of course, until like 4 in the morning. And that was why people would go to the after-hour clubs. And there were a number of after-hour clubs right at 13th and Locust where the incident took place. In fact, there was a famous club from that period called Club Whispers, which is where Mumia Jamal was waiting with his cab right outside that club for when the people came out to, you know, to get a passenger. What the police would do is they would go to all of these after-hour clubs, and they would tell them that they had to pay them off or they were going to raid them because they were serving alcohol after hours, which is against the law. So they would get payoff money from all the after-hour clubs. And, you know, like one officer would go, and they would get the money, and then they would split it up among all the officers on the different shifts that worked that area where that club was located, and the money would go up the chain of command to whoever the, you know, the highest ranking officer was who was in charge of these payoffs. Now, you've basically got this operation going on, just like the mafia operation. They come in and go, okay, you know, you need protection, we're going to sell you protection. This is the situation. And this is the this is what I want to point out. This is very significant. The police actually had an official police department form, which they would use to do what they called head counts in the after-hours clubs. In other words, on a regular basis, they would send uniformed police officers or, you know, detectives into the club, and they would count the number of customers in the club. And they would write this down on a police department form, and they would send this in to, you know, the supervising officer. And in fact, a couple of officers who appeared on the scene after Faulkner was killed had just been at one of these clubs filling out one of these forms. Now, there's no police reason in terms of enforcing the law why they needed to know how many people were in the clubs. Do you know why they did this? Would you like to know why they did
this? Yeah, I would.
The reason they did this was so that they would know how much money each club owner was making, because they could estimate it from the number of customers. So they would know how much protection money to charge. So when the club owner said, no, I can't pay that much money, business is not that good, they would say, what are you talking about? We got it documented here. You had 160 people in your club on Friday, and you had 180 people in the club on Saturday, and we know you charge so much for cover, and of course everybody there is drinking, so there's no way you can tell us you can't afford to pay this amount of protection money. They actually used it as an accounting method to figure out how much the club owners could afford to pay them within their profit margin for protection money. That's how organized and how rampant and pervasive the corruption was within the Philadelphia Police Department. So there's a number of other points that suggest that Faulkner indeed was the victim of a hit, because he apparently refused to go along with this stuff, and presumably, instead of taking the protection money, he would actually go out and arrest the people who were selling drugs or the prostitutes, and there was a lot of ill feeling about this and suspicion that Faulkner himself might have been an FBI informer. Because Faulkner was transferred to the 6th Precinct from the 23rd Precinct, and it had come out that there were police officers in the 23rd Precinct who were acting as informers for the FBI. So the fact he came in from the 23rd Precinct may have made him suspicious to the people in his precinct in the first place. Also, Faulkner's wife was interviewed about a week after her husband was killed. And she said two things in her interview that are very significant. You know, she was saying there are two very unusual things that happened around the incident. One was that about 2 weeks before Officer Faulkner was killed, he had tried to get that night off. The night that he was killed, he had tried to get that night off about 2 weeks earlier because they wanted to go to a concert or something, and they'd refused to give him the night off.
Hmm.
The other thing that's very suspicious and significant is that his normal routine, Faulkner's normal routine, was that he would drive down to the station in his civilian clothes, put on his uniform at the station, and put on his bulletproof vest at the station. But that night, for some reason, and this almost never happened, but that night, for some reason, he put on his uniform at home, directly out on patrol, and he did not put on his bulletproof vest. And had he had his vest on that night, he might have survived, because the first shot might have been stopped by the vest, and he might have been able to defend himself. So, you know, when his widow made those statements, you know, a week later, that was just, for her, something unusual and kind of an ironic twist of fate.
Right.
That if only, you know, things had been different, Faulkner would not have been killed. But now if we look at that from the perspective of the evidence we have now, that would be additional circumstantial evidence that, in fact, somebody in the police department was involved in setting him up to be killed that night.